until I'm hanging upside down from the pole like a pig on a spit. I tighten my grip and wonder what the hell to do next. Any ideas? I ask Erwan.
Claro, he responds. Sure, lots of them.
It's an excellent teaching moment, the perfect opportunity to dig into his mental archives and pull out a few of the innovations he's compiled over the years. I've seen them in his notes, pages and pages of stick figure drawings dating back to Georges Hébert's original field experiments. Erwan has a lot of wisdom to pass on, but instead he just stands there, arms folded across his chest. He doesn't give me a clue, or even a smile. Neither do Zucchetto or Fabio. They've become hardcore converts to the essence of Erwan's philosophy. When that volcano blows, you've got to be ready to go on your own. You won't have any lifting partner to ease the bar off your chest. No volunteer handing you Gatorade at the 20-mile mark. A group dynamic may be our natural impulse, but in a pinch, count on being a lonely man. The only thing you can always rely on is the ingenuity and raw mobility pre-programmed into your system by 2 million years of hope and fear. My hands are slick with sweat and starting to slip off the pole. Just to get a better grip till I can think of something, I slowly start swinging from side to side, building up momentum. At the top of every swing, my body is suspended for a sec in mid-air. That's when I move my hands and feet farther up the pole, gliding higher and higher with almost no pain or effort.
Ah, you learned my secret,
Erwan calls from down below as I approach the top of the pole.
The best secret of all. Your body always has another trick up its sleeve.
Chapter 29. May God deliver you into the hands of the Greeks. A Corsican curse Paddy liked to quote. Paddy had a few tricks up his own sleeve. He had a pretty good notion of what to expect from the butcher, and so he'd schemed accordingly. The butcher was vicious but cautious, preferring to hit a target he knew wouldn't hit back. He wouldn't storm into the mountains after he discovered General Kreiper was missing. No, he'd make a move only when he knew what was going on. So first he'd fan out his spies and ransack the coastal villages, and that would lead him right to General Kreiper's staff car. With a note inside and the phony British commando clues scattered around. And by that point, Paddy's last two bits of magic gang trickery would be in play. As soon as SOE headquarters got word they'd made the snatch, BBC Radio would broadcast a newsflash saying the general was off the island and en route to Cairo. At the same time, British planes would letterbomb Crete with leaflets saying British commandos had delivered the general to Egypt. The butcher would be furious, but he wasn't crazy. With no blood on the ground, he wouldn't launch a manhunt if there was no man to hunt. He'd probably triple down his attempts to root out rebel nests, but those attacks would be localized and concentrated on specific targets. Unless he absolutely had to, there's no way he'd risk any more abductions by scattering his men across the mountains. That would take the heat off a little, giving Paddy and his gang enough breathing space to dart out in the open and get the general up and over Stony Mount Ida, and then down to the real embarkation point on the southern coast. All around, it was a lovely plan, for about 6 hours. Paddy had split his band into three teams. Billy was up front, leading the general to the first rendezvous point. Paddy was catching up from the west after ditching the car on the beach. Andoni Zoidakis and his crew were coming from the east with Alfred Fenske, the general's driver. Fenske was really slowing them down. He was still so wobbly from that crack across the skull Billy Moss gave him that he could barely walk. With sunup approaching, Zoidakis decided to take cover and let Fenske rest until dark. They wouldn't have to worry about search parties until noon, maybe mid-after. Zoidakis froze. He poked his head out for a look, then yanked it back. Impossible. The Germans were on the hunt already. It was still night. How could they even know the general was gone? But there they were, fanned out in a search sweep just 300 yards or so behind them. Zoidakis had to decide, fast, if they could slip away, with Fenske stumbling all over the place. Zoidakis must have looked worried, because the German driver got curious and stood up to see what was going on. Zoidakis slashed Fenske's throat before he could open his mouth. Almost immediately, Zoidakis regretted it. Fenske hadn't actually done anything wrong, and Paddy was going to be so upset. Which reminded him, they had to get word to Paddy right away. For some reason, the hunt was already on. Destination One was a cave just outside the village of Anoia. The closer Billy and his team got, the more trouble they had with the general. As soon as Kreiper felt confident he wouldn't be executed, he slowed down to a grumbling trudge. He was thirsty and really hungry, he complained. They'd grabbed him on his way home for supper, and his leg was killing him. Why'd they have to drag him out of the car like that? And where was his knight's cross? Had anyone seen his medal? Billy kept pushing him along, finally making it to the cave in a cliff face. They pushed the general up, one handhold at a time, then slipped inside and disguised the mouth with torn branches. One of the gang slipped off to Anoia to rustle up some food and ask around for news. Paddy and George Tirakis weren't far behind, but instead of going directly to the rendezvous, Paddy slipped into Anoia. He needed to get a messenger to Tom Dunbabin right away, and then sit tight for Tom's reply. Tom was the last crucial part of Paddy's magic gang plan. Paddy was counting on him to make radio contact with Cairo and coordinate the letter bombing, the BBC broadcast, and the pickup boat. As Paddy and George entered Anoia, doors and windows slammed shut around them. All talk and laughter died at the washing troughs. Women turned their backs and thumped their laundry with noisy vehemence. Cloaked shepherds, in answer to greeting, gaze past us in silence, Paddy observed. In a moment we could hear women's voices wailing into the hills. The black cattle have strayed into the wheat, and our in-laws have come. So this is what it's like for the Germans, Paddy realized. Good. Many of the most effective Cretan freedom fighters, the Andantes, were sons of Anoia. So deep was the villagers' loathing for the Germans that even though Paddy was a well-known friend, all they could see was the uniform he was wearing. Even when he knocked up at the house of his good friend, the rebel priest Father Haretis, he wasn't allowed through the door. It's me, Papadia, he whispered to the priest's wife. He gave her his code name. It's me, Mihaly. What Mihaly? She replied innocently. I don't know any Mihaly. Then she took a closer look. Only when she recognized the familiar gap between Paddy's teeth did she let him inside. Paddy didn't explain what he was doing there or why he was dressed like a German corporal, and everyone knew better than to ask. Father Haretti simply sent a boy off with Paddy's message to Tom Dunbabin, then laid out food. Paddy was still resting and waiting for Tom's reply when leaflets began fluttering down over the village. Excellent. The runner must have made it to Tom's hideout in record time. Paddy got one and read. To all Cretans. Last night, the German general Kreiper was abducted by bandits. He is now being concealed in the Cretan mountains. His whereabouts cannot be unknown to the populace. Wait, what happened to Paddy's leaflets? If the general is not returned within 3 days, all villages in the Heracleion district will be burned to the ground. The severest measures of reprisal will be brought to bear on the civilian population. Damn. Either way you looked at it, it didn't make sense. If the Germans had found the car already, how did they know the general was in the mountains and not on a boat? And if they hadn't found the car, why were they searching? Paddy's calculations turned out to be very right and very wrong. As he expected, the butcher didn't tear off in a rage and start burning villages. He was taking his time, asking questions, and circling the trail. But instead of falling for Paddy's ruse, the butcher was getting dangerously close to the truth. The butcher first became suspicious after one of the sentries radioed the fortress to ask about the general's whereabouts. The butcher always ranted that the Cretans were brutes and the Brits were harmless pests. But privately, he suspected there was a lot more going on in the mountains than he could see. Air convoys were swarmed within moments of leaving Crete. German sergeants left their rooms for an hour and returned to find them ransacked. An Italian general vanished from under the butcher's nose and popped up in Cairo. And now a commanding general goes on a nighttime joyride? No. Something was up. So this time, the butcher went to the maps and began thinking like a bandit. If General Kuiper were dead, they'd know it by now. His corpse was too valuable as a shock tactic, and attacking German morale was a key resistance tactic. The butcher couldn't prove it, but he had to suspect it was bandits, not German soldiers, who were chalking walls with graffiti like Scheiße Hitler. Hitler is a shit. And Wir wollen nach Haus. We want to go home. So where do you hide a German officer on an island full of Germans? The general's car was definitely spotted in Heraklion. It never arrived in Hania. The northern shore was too exposed for boats. The coastal villages had too many turncoats. That left Anoia. High in the hills, bristling with patriotic fever, gateway to Mount Ida, and a single night's hike from the road to Heraklion. That had to be it. They kidnapped him and fled to Anoia. The butcher sent out the order. By first light, he wanted 30,000 troops on the march and plane crews ready to scramble. "Search the hills around Heraklion," he commanded. "Get aerial photos of all the footpaths leading out of Heraklion. But our priority is Anoia." By dawn, the butcher had seized back the advantage. The kidnappers wouldn't expect anyone to confirm the general's disappearance until morning. By then, they'd be surrounded. Paddy expected a pretty hot response at Father Haretis's house when they discovered what kind of a jam he'd gotten them into, and he was right. The room was convulsed with incredulity, then excitement, and finally, by an excess of triumphant hilarity, Paddy observed. We could hear feet running in the street, and shouts and laughter. The entire village was facing destruction, but instead of cowering, they were erupting with joy.
"Hey," Paddy heard one old man say. "They'll burn them all down one day, and what then? My house was burnt down 4 times by the Turks. Let the Germans burn it down for a fifth. And they killed scores of my family, scores of them, my child. Yet here I am. We're at war, and war has all these things. You can't have a wedding feast without meat. Fill up the glasses, Papadia."
They loved Paddy's plot because it was more than an act of war. It was a tribute to them, personally, as Cretans. Nothing is more Cretan or more Greek than pulling off an impossible hustle. Greek heroes were always stealing stuff. The bigger and weirder and more impossible, the better. Sticky fingers are so important to Greek theology, it's hard to find a myth that doesn't involve someone pulling a fast one. Half of Hercules' 12 labors were heists, including snatching an Amazon's girdle and a team of man-eating horses. Prometheus made off with the god's fire. Jason grabbed the golden fleece. Theseus was constantly dragging off women who caught his eye, namely a warrior queen and a Cretan princess. The Iliad and the Odyssey are a pair of true crime classics. Nothing gets done in either one until someone gets sneaky. And that someone is usually Odysseus, whose rogue's eye made him the greatest of the Greek heroes. Breaking into Troy by hiding inside a hollow horse was Odysseus's idea, and he warmed up for it by first sneaking behind enemy lines and making off with a rival king's armor and prized war horses. Odysseus was a born thief, the descendant of a long line of light fingers. His dad was Laertes, one of the fleece-seizing Argonauts, although his true biological father was rumored to be Sisyphus, famous for robbing house guests. His granddad was the thief lord Autolycus, and his great-granddad was Hermes, god of thieves. But for all their shenanigans, you don't see the heroes piling up a mountain of loot. They're not in it for gold. Given a choice, Odysseus would be happier farming at home with his wife. Stealing wasn't his job. It was a calling, an art, a way of making the impossible possible and the imaginary real. Pulling off a clever heist is as close as humans can come to magic, allowing something in your mind's eye to suddenly appear in your hand. Other religions condemn thieves as sinners and outcasts, but the ancient Greeks shrugged and decided, hey, let's give them their own god, because who else will teach us that our stuff doesn't really matter? That our possessions are fleeting, forgettable, and that anything you have, someone else can take? What you'll be remembered for isn't your wealth and power, but your creative imagination, your metis. The brazen metis of a thief, that was the animating spirit of ancient Greek, and it sparked an explosion of creativity unrivaled in intellectual history. The Olympics, the Acropolis, democratic government, trial by jury, the dramatic rules of comedy and tragedy, Pythagorean and Archimedean geometry, Aristotelian and Platonic philosophy, the predictive cycles of astronomy, and the humanitarian principles of medicine. It all came careening out of a tiny island nation so small and thinly populated. It was as if the dominant force on Western thought for more than 3,000 years was the state of Alabama. What fueled it all was a kind of outlaw outlook. Instead of relying on laws passed down from some god or a king, let's think like outlaws. Let's think for ourselves. An outlaw outlook calls on every citizen to create, not conform. To decide what is right and wrong and act on it, not just bar along with the rest of the herd. Outlaws have to be poised, smart, and independent. They have to cultivate allies, assess risk, and keep their antennae fine-tuned to everyone and everything around them. Outlaws focus on what people can do, not what they shouldn't. In Athens, the outlaw outlook worked so beautifully, it became a civic responsibility. The Athenians still had laws, but they were proposed by average citizens, not imperial rulers. Anyone who started acting too bossy, who thought he knew what was best for everyone else, was marched to the border and sent into exile under Athens's steely no-tyrants policy. Not even gods had the final say. Instead of one almighty, there were a dozen, all divvying up the work and jockeying for position. Zeus was the big dog, but he was constantly being one-upped and second-guessed. One of his biggest worries was being outsmarted by his first wife, whose name, of course, was Metis. She was an alluring titan known for her magical cunning and close friendship with that master thief, Prometheus. Zeus managed to muster a little cunning of his own and con Metis into briefly transforming herself into a fly, giving him a chance to grab and swallow her, forever uniting, in the eyes of the ancient Greeks, the bond between imagination and immortality. The spirit of resourcefulness was now buzzing inside a god who would never die. Not that everyone was on board. An outlaw outlook meant freedom, which put it at odds with BA, brute force. BA was for kings and conquerors, the mighty and the muscle-bound. Metis was power to the people, especially the weak and poor who had no other options. Achilles was bursting with BA and sneered at the schemes of Odysseus, who was equal to Zeus in Metis. Too late. Achilles discovered that even a golden warrior can be taken out by a nobody with a good idea. An idea like, say, infuriating your enemy so much he forgets to cover his vulnerable heel. Achilles' cousin, Ajax, was just as much of a raging bull and learned the same lesson. When he wrestled Odysseus, he was twisted around and thumped down on his back before he saw it coming.
It is with Metis, rather than Bia, that a woodcutter is better. The ancient warrior Nestor coaches his son in the Iliad. It is Metis that lets a pilot on the wine-dark sea keep a swift ship on course when a gale strikes, and Metis makes one charioteer better than another. For young Brits like Chan and Paddy, brute force was everything they were trying to escape. BA was boarding school beatings, Victorian prudishness, the blind obedience to the dogma of theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die, that sent their fathers and brothers marching into machine gun fire during the Great War. Weirdly, religion had a lot to do with it. Once the Greek myths were replaced by Christianity, the raucous tribe of Olympians were replaced by just one god. Instead of becoming our own heroes, we were given a list of commandments and told to follow the rules, bend our knees, and wait for a savior. Not on Crete, though. The island of heroes still followed the ancient code, and when Chan and Paddy and Billy Moss arrived, they discovered a whole new level of outlaw thinking.
Clepsy, clepsy, translatable into English as swiping or pinching, but hardly stealing, is something of a Cretan sport, Billy learned after being awakened with a cold splash of outlaw thinking when his bedroll and warm clothes were nicked by a fellow rebel. Sympathy is usually on the side of the pincher rather than of the loser. If you allow someone to steal from you, it is you who are the mug. He, the clever fellow.
Crete had been under the heel of invaders for so long that stealing had become the job of patriots. Sheep rustling was the only way for resistance fighters to survive during the Turkish occupation, so heroic struggle became synonymous with banditry. They're even the same word. In Cretan dialect, rebels and robbers are both klephs.
It's one of the most important Greek lessons you could learn,
George Sikundakis told a new SOE recruit, urging him to steal some grapes.
As your teacher, I insist on it.
To survive on Crete, you had to think and act like an old-time hero. Which is exactly what Paddy had done. He'd gone into the Minotaur's lair, and not only defeated the monster, but snuck it out on a leash. The roar of trucks brought an end to the merriment. A German convoy was grinding up the mountain road and pouring into the Anoia town square. Within minutes, soldiers were hopping down and scurrying into formation.
Up, up, the Cretans told Paddy. You've got to get out of here.
The Germans could surround the village at any moment and begin the house-to-house ransack. Paddy and George scrambled their gear and headed toward the door. Could someone guide them to Billy's hideout? And was there a donkey they could bring along for the general?
Yes, yes, their host replied. Whatever you need, but hurry!
You'll see, Paddy promised as he went out the door.
Those 3 days will go by, and there won't be any villages burnt or even shooting.
Privately, however, he wasn't feeling so bully.
I prayed that urgency would lend wings to the messenger's heels, he thought to himself, and scatter our counter-leaflets and the BBC news of the general's departure from the island.
The town square was teeming with troops as Paddy and George cautiously worked their way through the streets. Paddy couldn't figure out how the butcher got his men to Anoia so quickly, but he was even more perplexed by why they were still standing around. The butcher had the drop on them, so why didn't he snap shut the trap? If the Germans had circled Anoia as soon as they arrived, Paddy and Billy might be in chains by now. So what were they waiting for? The butcher was frozen by a chilling thought.
What if it's a feint?
The bandits were smart, so smart that the butcher hadn't managed to lay his hands on a single Brit the entire time he'd been on Crete. Every time he got close, they were one jump ahead. So could trapping them really be so easy this time? Or did they want to be chased? The bandits had to know that nothing would outrage the Germans more than kidnapping a general from right under the nose of the Gestapo. Thousands of German foot soldiers would be hot on their trail, racing into the mountains and drawing fleets of fighter planes into the backcountry, leaving Fortress Crete and the capital exposed. So that was their game. Maybe, the butcher thought, Kreiper's abduction was an Allied ploy to make him move large forces towards the mountains, thereby allowing them to land on the plains while the Andantes and commandos attacked from the rear. He wasn't going to fall for it. The butcher sent word to Anoia, "Bring one company back to Heraklion immediately." He ordered the reconnaissance planes back to base and the leafleting postponed till further notice. Before scattering his troops all over the mountains, the butcher needed to be ready for invasion. By nightfall, the coast was secure. The hunt for General Kreiper was ready to resume at full force. But Paddy and his crew had already slipped back into the wilderness. Chapter 30. Where danger is, deliverance also beckons. Frederick Holderlin, Patmos. Chris White and I began hunting Paddy's trail as soon as the sun rose high enough for us to see the ground. We'd set off before daybreak from Heraklion, hopping a bus to the exact spot along the shore where, according to Chris's calculations, Paddy had ditched the general's car. Chris checked his bearings. Mount Ida straight ahead. Rocky thumbnail of beach dead behind. Yep, we'd found the right meadow. But there was no hint of a path. Nothing except a snarl of brambles leading straight to an unclimbable cliff.
"Brilliant, isn't it?" Chris said. "It would have been just as wild when Paddy came through. You can just imagine the Germans looking at this and thinking, well, they certainly didn't go that way."
Chris had been exploring on foot over the past 2 years with his brother Pete and exchanging notes with his fellow escape sleuths, Alan Davis and Christopher Paul and Tim Todd, so he was pretty sure he could now connect all the dots of the escape route. Except, that is, dot number one. Pete would have been a huge help. His years of work in the New Forest had given him a flair for backcountry navigation, as I'd learned on our previous expedition. But he couldn't make it this time. It was just Chris and I, and we were lost before we began. Chris was unfazed. He scanned the thorny mess slowly, walking as far into the brambles as he could, and dropping to a crawl when he couldn't, working his way back and forth until his hand shot into the air, and we were on our way. We followed the faint goat track high into the hills, climbing in and out of gullies until we emerged, just before noon, on a bluff overlooking a weird oasis. Far below was a small cluster of stone buildings, surrounded by tiny gardens. We picked our way down and entered a silent cobblestone courtyard. Chris reached for the bell rope over the entrance, but before he could pull, a little hobbit's door creaked open.
"Kalos orizate," we heard from somewhere in the darkness. "Welcome."
We ducked inside the low door and found ourselves in a small, stone-floored kitchen. A monk with a chest-length black beard pressed a hand over his heart and gave a slight bow. He was Father Timothy Stavros, curator of the tiny Vusaku Monastery. How, he asked in halting English, could he be of service? Chris pulled out his letter, the one in Greek and English that explained our interest in the Kreiper kidnapping. Father Timothy nodded.
"Yes, they were here."
He led us through the kitchen and outside to a porch overlooking the valley. Clay bowls full of forage greens and spinach covered a shelf along the wall. Hanging from nails in the beams overhead were mesh bags full of snails, airing for a few days as they purged themselves for cooking. Snails were freedom fighters' food. You could harvest them on the run, and they go dormant and keep fresh in your pockets until you were in the clear to cook. The Germans didn't eat them, so villagers could gather them by the bushel without worrying they'd be seized, and sneak them to guerrillas without fearing their food supplies would look suspiciously low. Koli mi stari has become one of my favorite meals on Crete. snail stewed in a broth of garlic and tomatoes and olive oil, with maybe an onion and some torn mint thrown in, and a fistful of coarse cracked wheat added to thicken it into a paella-like porridge. We sat down as another monk silently appeared with a pitcher of cold water and a plate of small, hard biscuits sprinkled with sesame seeds. Vasaku was built more than 400 years ago, Father Timothy explained, but had been repeatedly destroyed by generations of invaders.
18 of us were killed by the Turks, he said. 2 of us were executed here, he pointed a few yards away to a spot in the garden, by the Germans. People who needed food came for help, so we helped. The Germans didn't like that.
Father Timothy wasn't here at the time. He's only about 50, and had originally been a florist in Rutimno. For the past 8 years, he's been mostly alone at Vasaku. The older members of the order have all died off, leaving Father Timothy as one of the last living custodians of the monastery's stormy history.
The general spent about an hour here that night, Father Timothy said,
which baffled us until suddenly it made perfect sense. Billy and his prisoner had gotten out of the car past Vasaku, not behind, so it must have been Paddy in his German uniform the monks had seen. Paddy and George Tirakis would have been parched and ravenous when they arrived here long after midnight. They'd had nothing to eat or drink since early in the evening, and had been on a roller coaster of fighting and fleeing ever since. Their best hope for a place to refill their tanks was the monastery, so George would have banged on the door while Paddy lurked in the shadows. An hour was a long time to linger, but Paddy and George had to play it smart. They needed to gather their strength for the long climb to Anoia, and they wouldn't want to carry anything that could be traced back to the monks if they were caught. They'd have taken the time to finish their biscuits and mutton. Then they were off. Father Timothy pushed a bag of his hard homemade biscuits into our hands as we got up to go. Chris and I trundled down the long slope into the valley, then followed a creek that knifed through a gorge with rolling foothills along both banks. By late afternoon, the monk's biscuits were gone. My water pack had an ominously empty-sounding swish, and the foothills on our side of the gorge had sharpened into a sheer cliff. Across the creek, we faced a choice. Pull ourselves up a long staircase of cropped terraces carved into the mountain face, or gamble on a dirt road that might spiral all the way to Anoia if it didn't dead-end in a pasture. The sun had sunk behind the mountain, leaving us only an hour of good light, but the terraces and dirt road were good signs that Anoia was right above us. Chris pointed to the cliff rising at our backs. Only a Japanese painter could have loved that thing. It was snarled with prickly oak and so sheer, it could have been cut from the mountain with a cleaver.
Somewhere in that mess, Billy stashed the general the first night, Chris said.
He and Pete had punished themselves searching for the cave on their last trip, but I could see why they'd gotten nowhere. Even if you knew where to go, you'd be at the mercy of prickers and dodgy handholds. Billy Moss described the cave as so painfully small and hard to reach that they only pushed inside as a last resort.
"Germans coming," one of the guerrillas had warned him. "Plenty Germans in village."
Billy and his crew were right out in the open, taking a breather along the banks of the stream because Paddy had told them Anoia would be safe.
"We hurriedly threw our kit onto our backs and made off along the bank of the stream," Billy would recall. 5 minutes later, we reached a steep cliff face, and up it we scrambled, heaving the general from foothold to foothold, until we found ourselves at the entrance of a tiny cave.
All four squeezed into a space barely big enough for two, then screened the entrance with branches. They huddled there, listening to the rasp of their own breathing as a German search plane growled by so low that Billy could peek out and see one of the rear crewmen searching the valley through binoculars. That evening, Billy and his crew led the general back down to the creek to meet up with Paddy. It was here, roughly where Chris and I were standing, that Paddy and Billy discovered that the man they were counting on most, Tom Dunbabin, might already have been captured.
"How is it going?" Paddy asked.
Is the General putting up a fuss?
Quite a pleasant catch, was Billy's assessment. Not the raving Nazi he might well have been.
Have you heard anything from Tom? Paddy asked.
Nothing,
Billy replied. His messenger had returned from Tom's hideout dumbfounded. He said he had searched the entire area for Tom, but had found no trace of him, nor had anyone in the district a notion of his whereabouts. This was sad news. Tom's radio operator turned up, but with a broken radio and no more idea than anyone else what happened to his boss. Tom Dunbabin wasn't just their link to the outside world. He was supposed to be spearheading all clandestine ops on the island. That meant one man, and one man alone, knew the secret locations of the last two remaining wireless operators, Tom.
He was the only open sesame to the other two stations, Paddy realized.
Without him, they could send messages only through a series of human firewalls, with each gorilla knowing only the identity of the next man in the chain. Chan Fielding had as much credibility on Crete as O Tom, as Dunbabin was known, and could possibly tighten up communications, but Chan hadn't made it back from Egypt yet. Were the Germans tightening the noose so quickly that Tom had to go into hiding? Or was he already in their hands? Paddy and Billy had both taken the precaution of using the human relay to send news of the kidnapping to another radio operator. But predictably, it arrived disastrously garbled. At that moment, the BBC was reporting that General Kuiper would be taken off the island, not was off.
"What about our leaflet drop?" Paddy asked.
"Cancelled," Billy replied. "Too much cloud cover for our planes to get through."
Billy and Paddy were still absorbing the bad news when worse arrived. The gorillas escorting the General's driver showed up without the driver. "Germans are everywhere," the gorillas reported. "There were full-scale drives," the Cretans told Paddy, "launched in every direction." And they themselves had only just escaped capture.
Okay, but where's the driver?
Andoni sliced a finger across his throat. Paddy was heartsick. Their chances for escape had just plummeted, and his dream of a bloodless, magic, gang-style triumph was over. As soon as the driver's body was discovered, the butcher would go berserk. He'd have to assume General Kuiper was dead as well, which meant he no longer had to worry about getting a hostage back alive. Instead of a rescue operation, it would be total war. The butcher's only objective now would be vengeance for the murder of a brother officer. Time to get moving. Ahead lay Mount Ida, sprawling across a quarter of the island and climbing to over 8,000 feet. The general was still complaining about his injured leg, so they helped him up on the donkey and moved out, following a nearly invisible goat track into the woods.
"It was vital for us to get into the mountains and among friends," Paddy decided, "away from the enemy-infested plain and in the right direction for escape by sea at high speed."
"Wait, by sea?"
The gorillas were doubtful.
"Why don't we fly him out wolf-style?"
Ugh, wasn't the sky already dark enough without that name coming up? Otto Skorzeny, Hitler's wolf. The evil genius with a dueling scar down his cheek and a specialty in killing anyone, anywhere, and disappearing without a trace. Whenever a job seemed impossible, the wolf was called in. He led a special force of Jagdkommandos, hunting warriors, who were said to live off the land, think for themselves, and never be daunted by the disastrous mess they often found themselves in. A year earlier, Skorzeny and his hunters had snuck into a fortified Italian castle high on a mountain and broken Benito Mussolini out of prison. Mussolini had been overthrown in a coup, but Hitler was determined to rescue
Italy's greatest son, our dear friend and close ally,
and restore him to power. Skorzeny landed by glider at night with a small attack squad, then forced the 200-man guard detail to surrender. Skorzeny spirited Mussolini to an escape plane in a nearby field, and before long, Il Duce was back in command. To prevent Hungary's leader, Admiral Miklos Horthy,
from surrendering to the Soviets, Skorzeny kidnapped Horthy's son, rolled him into a carpet, and snuck him off to a concentration camp, where he was held hostage until the end of the war. A few months later, as the story goes, the Wolf parachuted into Iran, intent on assassinating Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt with a single blow. The Wolf and his hunters crept closer as the big three Allied leaders were meeting in Tehran to discuss war strategy. Just in time, a Russian spy exposed Operation Long Jump, and many of the hunters were captured. But Skorzeny got away, re-emerging in an American uniform and jeep far behind enemy lines as he atomized from place to place, sabotaging Allied troops, and getting so close to Supreme Headquarters that for days at a time, General Dwight Eisenhower had to be hidden in a guarded location. "Skorzeny is the most dangerous man in Europe," Eisenhower fumed. "Public enemy number one." "We couldn't evacuate our prisoners by air, in Skorzeny style," Paddy told the disappointed Cretans. "The Germans had put all the big mountain plateau out of action for long-range aircraft by forcing labor gangs to litter them with cairns of stones." But the burning question wasn't whether they could follow in the Wolf's footsteps. It was whether the Wolf was following theirs. Rather than flail around in pursuit of the kidnappers, why wouldn't the butcher call in Skorzeny and put the hunters on their trail? It made perfect sense. As an outlaw himself, Skorzeny would know exactly what Paddy was planning. Instead of chasing the kidnappers, he'd think 10 moves ahead and be waiting in ambush. So the faster Paddy and his crew ran, the closer they could be getting to the Wolf. Chapter 31. It makes people rub their eyes in amazement that this proverbial home of individuality, lawlessness and revolt should unite, when the need came, in this durable harmony. But so it was. Patrick Lee Fermor. Chris and I arrived in Anoia about the time of day Paddy would have been slipping out, pulling ourselves up the last terrace as the sun went down. At the entrance to town was an iron signpost so ominous it looked more like a warning than a welcome. When we got closer, we discovered why. Once the butcher discovered his suspicions about Anoia were true, he erupted in a Hitler-like fury. What he did next was engraved on that grim memorial. "Order of the German commander of the garrison of Crete. Since the town of Anoia is a center of the English espionage in Crete, since the Anoians carried out the murder of the sergeant of the Yene Gave garrison, since the Anoians carried out the sabotage at Damasta, since the Andates of various resistance bands find asylum and protection in Anoia, and since the abductors of General Kuiper pass through Anoia, using Anoia as a stopping place when transporting him, we order its razing to the ground and the execution of every male Anoian who is found within the village and within an area of 1 kilometer round it. Hanya, 13844. The commander of the garrison of Crete, H. Muller." The butcher's troops surrounded the village and penned everyone inside. More than 100 people were dragged to the town square and murdered. The survivors fled into the mountains, while everything they had, their homes, their food, their clothing and blankets, went up in flames behind them. 2 elderly sisters were too afraid to leave their home. They were burned to death inside. The butcher was unrelenting. For 3 weeks, his men pounded away at the little town, dynamiting buildings and searching the hills for any Anoian men who escaped the dragnet. By the time the butcher's rage subsided, there was nothing left of the 900-year-old city on the hill except rotting corpses and smouldering rubble. Chris and I got a glimpse of the aftermath in a taverna off the town square. A mural filled the entire side wall and depicted the valley Chris and I had just climbed up from. 2 German soldiers have their hands in the air, and a 3rd has dropped to his knees. They're surrounded by Anoian freedom fighters, about to open fire. It's a strange and awful image to stare at over a glass of raki and a plate of spanikopita, but it explains why Anoia exists again today. Guerrilla sniping became so common that for the rest of the war and afterwards, the area around Anoia would be known as the Devil's Triangle.
"I saw Germans crying," one Anoian would recall. "I saw it when they shuffled into our ambush like sheep and didn't stand a ghost of a chance."
Strategically, the Butcher's Massacre was a terrible mistake. Stripped of everything they had to live for, the Anoians were ready to fight to the death. They dug in, determined to out-endure the invaders. And they did. Anoia was eventually rebuilt with such pride and charm, it feels like it was never gone. The streets are steep and narrow, sloping naturally into the side of the mountain. Small, whitewashed houses cluster around a pleasant town square ringed by shady trees and family cafes. Looming overhead by daylight and moonlight is the majestic, snowy presence of mighty Mount Ida, symbolic birthplace of the rebel lord Zeus and gateway to bandit country and the freedom of the sea. But as gateways go, it's a punisher. By foot, the fastest route out of Anoia is the trail created by and for goats. It starts with a climb steep enough to make you pump your knees with your hands, then plunges you through acres of the same kind of knife-edged lava rock that left Paddy barefoot the day he arrived. One look was enough for the general to insist his leg was so injured he needed to ride the whole way.
Seen in silhouette upon his mule, the general looked for all the world like Napoleon on his retreat from Moscow, Billy observed. And we, as jaded-looking a rabble as ever fought an enemy, must have perfectly suited this picture.
By 2 in the morning, the kidnap party had been hiking for more than 6 hours. Through the darkness, they followed the clonging of sheep bells to a small hut with the smell of wood smoke wafting from the roof hole.
The shepherd, a dear old man with white whiskers and almost no teeth, was delighted to see us and immediately asked us into his hut so we could rest and warm ourselves in front of the fire, Billy would relate.
Even though the old man had been rousted from sleep and opened his door to find a band of armed thugs leading a German general on a donkey, he obeyed the Cretan hospitality code of Xenia. He offered food, he offered shelter, he asked no questions.
The shepherd gave us some cheese to eat, and with it some rock bread which was first left to soak in a stone jug, Billy noted.
Once the general had thawed out and the starving kidnappers had shared portions of the shepherd's prison-style rations, it was time to be off.
We gave him a fond farewell and were soon on our way again.
Giving an enemy who'd terrorized his island a bite to eat and a place by the fire was the last kindness the old man would ever perform. Soon after, Billy later found out, a German foraging patrol in search of food shot the shepherd in the back of the head and stole his flock. The kidnappers had to pick up the pace. Dawn was coming fast, and the most treacherous obstacle still lay ahead, the Nida Plateau, a nearly half-mile stretch of pasture as smooth and open as a football field. Nida is one of the marvels of the Cretan Mountains. It's treeless and almost supernaturally flat, leading like a royal carpet straight to the base of Mount Ida. It would be an ideal airstrip if it weren't such a death trap. It's perfect for landing planes, but the surrounding hills make it a sniper's dream. Nida could only be crossed by night. By day, the Germans would be watching it from the air with search planes growling around and around the perimeter. Except the more the kidnappers walked, the farther away Nida got. The Lasiti Range, south of Anoia, is bewitched. It's a masterpiece of deceptive topography, with hills so steep and tightly packed together that when you see one in the distance, you won't notice the other three in between. Every time you pull yourself up a peak and expect to see Nida waiting below, you're sure to find another climb awaiting. You won't find it any easier on the descents either. The gorges are so clotted with tumble-down stone from the mountaintops, the kidnappers could only avoid tripping by lifting their tired legs as high on the way down as they did on the way up. Just as the sky was turning pink, the band made it to the grassy plain and hurried the general across. In the grey morning light, they could see the dark outlines of rebel watchmen all across the hilltops. The general was shocked. The butcher's propaganda had made him believe rebel manpower was nothing more than a few scared Brits and a handful of bandits.
"Kreiper was very impressed," noted the rebel fighter Georges Franjuli Takis, known as Scuttle George. "By our guerrillas posted all along the southern heights, watching over us without coming down. He must have thought the whole mountain was full of them."
When one of the band wanted to slip into town past German sentries, several others offered him their German travel passes.
"Have they all got our identity papers?"
Kreiper asked Paddy. "You would never be able to escape from the men you see all around you," replied Paddy. Angry elf eyes backed him up. Whenever the general glanced back, he found a little old man glaring daggers at him.
Manolis Secretis was very small and wore a sort of fez, like a deacon's cap, as Scuttle George put it. He didn't care for the general either, and stared at him fiercely throughout the journey.
Tough talk didn't come naturally to Paddy, but as they pushed into a damp cave at the foot of Mount Ida to hide out for the day, the time had come to make the general believe this was checkmate, and his last chance for rescue was gone. Because the following night, they'd be fully exposed as they summited the barren moonscape of Mount Ida. Even if there was some place up there to hide, their footprints in the snow would give them away. It was a vampire's mission. Either get off the mountain and undercover by sunrise, or you're dead. And if the general figured out they were making it up as they went along, he could outfox them with a slow drip of subtle sabotage. All he had to do was drop items from his pockets in the dark for search teams to follow, or detour the escape route by pretending he knew German outposts were up ahead, or simply clutch his chest and fall down. Paddy couldn't let that happen. He had to persuade the general he was in the grip of a clockwork operation run by skilled and deadly masterminds, and not, in reality, a seat-of-the-pants scheme cooked up in a bathroom after an all-night party by a military school reject who spent the past 5 years freeloading across Europe as a wandering playboy poet. So when the general sighed one morning as the sun was rising over Mount Ida and recalled Horace's ode to Mount Soracte, Paddy seized the chance to take his rook.
"Vidis ut alta, stet nive candidum Soracte," the general murmured. "You see Soracte standing white and deep, this snow."
"Nec jam sustinant onus," Paddy blurted.
"Silvae laborantes geluce, flamina constitarent acuto."
"The woods in trouble, hardly able to carry their burden, and the rivers halted by sharp ice."
"One of the few odes of Horace I know by heart," Paddy would reveal.
"I was in luck." He kept reeling off verses until he reached the end. The general sat in silence.
"Well remembered," he finally muttered.
While the general dozed inside the cave, Paddy and Billy sat outside in the morning sun and got the morning's bad news. Tom Dunbabin was still missing, which meant their communication with Cairo was getting worse by the mile. The farther they fled, the farther behind they left the two remaining wireless operators.
In both cases, Billy realized, the journey would take the fleetest of runners at least 2 days to reach his destination, a further day to await Cairo's reply, and another 2 days in which to return to us.
5 days round trip for a single message. So, instead of a few days, it would now take a few weeks to coordinate a pickup to get the general off the island. Food was dangerously thin and about to get thinner. For the past 2 days, they'd hiked 12 hours each night on little more than bread crusts and water. Now they were facing 2 more weeks on the same starvation diet.
"It was impossible for our friends to help,"
Scuttle George reported. The villagers that would have helped us were all surrounded.
They were exhausted and hungry, but they couldn't give themselves more than a few hours to rest. Every day they spent in the same location increased the risk of getting trapped inside a German dragnet, or tracked to their hideout if Hitler's wolf showed up. Troops were already mobilizing to cut off their escape route on the far side of Mount Ida.
Large numbers of Germans are concentrating around the foothills of this mountain, and there is every reason to believe a full-scale drive over the area is imminent, the guerrillas told Billy.
Paddy saw only one way out. Solvitur ambulando. When in doubt, walk. Billy agreed.
We have decided that the best course for us is to make the long climb over Ida's crest and the descent down its southern slopes before the German action has time to develop.
They'd wait until nightfall, then do their best to get over Ida and into a fresh hideout before daybreak. If they were caught, it would be on the run. Paddy and Billy leaned back under a jagged crack running alongside the cave mouth and snatched a few moments of morning sun before going back undercover. Even though it was a top-secret operation, someone fished out a camera and snapped a shot, capturing one last image of the two tired men on what would likely be the last day of their lives.
"That's the crack," Chris White said. "Drop down and I'll show you."
I took a seat in the dirt and leaned back against the rock. Chris snapped a photo, then held it next to one he'd scanned from 1944. The details were identical. My head was right under the same crack, resting exactly where Paddy was before trying to get over Ida. Chris and I had just finished the trek from Anoia, and we'd accidentally put ourselves in a similar situation. We'd set off before dawn with no food, expecting to eat at an inn at the base of the mountain. But the inn was closed, the sun was going down, and the snow-capped peak loomed 8,000 feet overhead. There was only one way they could have pulled it off. Paddy and his gang must have been tapping into an ancient source of energy to power their way up Ida. They must have figured out how to use their own body fat as performance fuel. It's a technique as old as human existence, and the secret of some of the greatest athletic performances in endurance sports, as a broken-down Ironman was surprised to discover.
Chapter 32. I would argue that many of the ways in which we get sick today have a corporate, almost capitalist origin. We've also got this bizarre notion that finally came true, that our bodies don't really matter. Dr. Daniel Lieberman, Harvard biologist and author of The Story of the Human Body. In 1983, Stu Mittleman was suffering from a vicious knot on his foot that baffled every specialist he'd seen. Until then, he'd been having a spectacular year. I was now entering a new phase of my career that placed me among the top endurance athletes in the world, he'd recall. In the span of just a few months, he'd smashed his own American 100-mile record, finished second in the Ultraman World Championships, a double Ironman, and averaged nearly 100 miles a day to set a new national mark for the six-day run. Stu's ultra-distance heroics and Lady Killer's grin made him such a media sweetheart that Gatorade named him its first national spokesman, and Ted Koppel featured him on Nightline every evening during the six-day race. Stu was surfing a wave he couldn't have even dreamed of a few years earlier. For extreme endurance stunts, the 80s were a weird and wonderful time. Mega-distance events were suddenly back in fashion after a century in hibernation, and TV was eating it up. Multi-day races used to be all the rage back in the 1870s, not least because they added a dash of drama and cruelty to the typical test of speed. When you lined up at the start, you had no idea how far you'd have to run. You were the one who decided when you'd reach the finish, and how much rest, if any, you got in between. Superstars like Edward Payson Weston captivated the crowds by dreaming up new ways to challenge the clock and one another. In 1876, 70,000 fans turned out to watch Weston go head-to-head in a six-day challenge against Daniel O'Leary, an Irish door-to-door book salesman, who beat the champ and set a world's best of 520 miles.